This is Matthew Putman, and you're listening to Utility Function. My guest, Kwaku Mandela, sat down with his grandfather, Nelson Mandela, at the age of 4, while Nelson Mandela was under house arrest. This changed the lens which Kwaku saw the world and his responsibility to it. You hear this throughout the interview. Kwaku was born in Transkei, South Africa, but moved to America and returned to his homeland in 1993. He's an incredible filmmaker, dedicated to the arts, dedicated to narrative, and I think what really comes out the most in this interview is that he's dedicated to discourse. How do people speak to each other in a time of such division? This is obviously relevant in the U.S. right now, but there are some really interesting parallels to be made. We had a chance to discuss COVID response. We have a chance to discuss leadership in general. We had a chance to discuss youth and how we move technology and ideas forward. Kwaku's dedicated to honoring his grandfather, but at the same time, he's a partner and a president in South Africa's largest film and TV production company out of Africa, and is the co-founder of Africa Rising Foundation. Along with his cousin Nabata, he is also the global ambassador for the UNAIDS global HIV/AIDS campaign called Protect the Goal, and he's a founding member of Gen End It, which is aimed to fight HIV/AIDS epidemic. He also sits on the board of the Global Citizens Festival, where he champions youth activism. I could really go on about his charitable work that he's involved with and his really creative aspects of his life, including being a producer of the well-known film Inescapable. I really want you to enjoy this the way I did, and I hope it leads to discourse the way that it is already for me outside of this interview. It brings a positivity and inspiration that I certainly think his grandfather would be proud of and something that the rest of us can learn from. Enjoy the interview. Thank you so much, Kwaku. I noticed on your email, you have Global Citizen as your sort of sub-signature line. You know, that was something that I had always thought the least controversial thing in the world. I've always said that I consider myself a citizen of the world. I've worked and lived in many countries. And why do you think that actually is not the case now, if you do? I mean, we live in a time where you know, people are hyper-local now and not so global. And it's partially, I think, Trump administration. But do you have any thoughts on that? Or has anybody else commented on that?
I don't think that's changed. I think many of us are still global citizens of the world. The problem is a lot of that kind of thinking behind globalization has created gulfs amongst communities. You know, when you have a group of people that have traveled all over the world and learned about different histories and cultures and have an understanding of the need for technology and how that can propel and move people's lives forward, and you have a group of people who have not experienced that, have not had their lives changed by technology, have not been able to travel, whose core focus is how do they put the next meal on their table or how do they stop that local factory from shutting down in their small town. You know, those gulfs are real. They're not made up. Trump didn't, you know, miraculously just come up with, you know, a lie. He just played on those differences. He played on those truths. And I think it's something that we need to come to terms with. I'm sure you've heard of the kind of neoliberalism word being thrown around, the Davos clause. You know, again, these things are real. There's a gulf between those of us that live in places like New York City, you know, coastal metropolitan areas where you have Wall Street and you have the dynamism of, you know, theater and movies and fashion and all the things we take for granted every day. And then those that live in Scranton, Pennsylvania, who don't have that. They have a casino. And so I would strongly recommend that, you know, as much as we consider ourselves global citizens, we also consider ourselves human and get back to realizing that there are some humans who have been left behind. And I think we owe ourselves a duty, we owe our kids a duty, we owe our future a duty to make sure that's not the case, to begin to build bridges again instead of building walls.
Oh, man, that's beautiful the way you say that. And I believe this completely. And I'm from Akron, Ohio, which was this industrial town that you just certainly a sentiment that globalism has been a betrayal to the, you know, the Rust Belt in the United States is a real thing. And you don't want to minimize that. You know, there were people's parents and grandparents that lived middle-class lives, and now they're not. On the other hand, there is this education component that goes along with it.
Sure.
You know, figuring out what the real lies are behind what the more obvious lies are. And it's where I really try to figure out where are the divides in the United States, for instance, amongst those that are focusing locally or interested in rebuilding local communities. So why is there a difference between an African-American struggle, for instance, than what, you know, a sort of working class white struggle that somebody like J.D. Vance popularized in Hillbilly Elegy, and how those things now seem to be playing out. And maybe that is something that was a bit stoked by the by the Trump administration, but must have been there for a while.
It's been there for a while. I think, again, they played on those truths. There are lots of similarities between the experience, the lived experience of poor white communities and those of minority communities in America. But it's very easy to separate those across racial lines, right? It's very easy to separate those across actual territorial lines. And I think often politicians do that. You know, I think Trump was great at doing that. He was also great at exposing for a lot of people what they'd felt for a long time, which is that if the, you know, average politician that you've seen now for your entire life has come to your town when they need your votes, you know, when election's coming up, and then they disappear to DC and you don't hear from them again. You know, he presented an alternative. Now, was he a great alternative? No, but he was the only alternative that was different to what they've seen. And so, right. You know, again, oftentimes I've never been anywhere in America, and I've been, you know, pretty extensively throughout this country where I felt that a person couldn't change their mind, whether that person was a racist, a bigot, ignorant, that their mind couldn't be changed through a conversation, through interaction, through engagement. And unfortunately, that I think in the last few years has been lost. People refuse to have conversations. The notion to talk about politics at a dinner table or when you're out with your friends is almost seen as a bad thing, a negative thing, right? And so we've tuned out. And the only time we want to, you know, actually care about it is when we're coming up on an election every four years. And that's a very fearful thing. It means that the average citizen is not actually engaging in what affects them. And then you drill down even further beyond the national election to, you know, the election of your local senators, the election of your local house reps, the election of, you know, your magistrates. Like, people have no idea who their counselors are. You know, that's very scary stuff, because those people are meant to represent you. But unfortunately, we've reached a point where we're so distracted and also so consumed by so much information that is around us that we barely have time to focus on anything but ourselves.
Yeah, and I agree so much that discourse seems to be completely gone these days. And it's something that is kind of heartbreaking, because it's heartbreaking to me. I want to learn and grow. And the only way to do that is to, you know, throw stuff out there and then update if I'm wrong. And I, you know, I assume that I am going to be wrong often. And now there's nobody who wants to engage with me. So I have to do things like have a podcast for an excuse to speak to people. but it's and I think some people are going through that. And I want now, then we're stuck with an added level of, even if we wanted to get together and travel throughout the country or throughout the world and have conversation, we can't. You know, we have this pandemic that we're going through. So what was already this very local has become hyper local. And, you know, I worry about that. Have you noticed this at all, especially that you're dealing with, you know, young people who are forming views? They're forming them now, not amongst their peers physically, not amongst other adults, even perhaps over the last year. Have you noticed any difference in this?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, I do work with a global organization that focuses, you know, to try and tackle things like COVID-19 on a global level. And so maybe I'm seeing that more than the average person is. I think we have got hypersensitive and hyper-localized, but I'm not sure that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think one of the things that COVID forced the world globally to do was slow down. And people to really figure out what they wanted to do with their time, what their purpose was, and not just be preoccupied and moving from one thing to the next. The biggest fear that I have for, you know, human society is not that there's, you know, a kind of localized focus versus a global focus or even a national focus. It's the fact that we've stopped learning how to have a dialogue with each other. We've become proponents at hiding behind things like social media, hiding behind pleasantries, not actually talking to each other, even when we have differences. I think that's very dangerous. I think that just leads us into this false sense of security or hope that doesn't really exist. And we don't get anywhere as a human society.
I completely agree. It's my biggest worry as well. So I have to then look at, you know, evidence to see where our focus on what really matters during this time has been successful and worked. Oh my God, it's true. I got to know my kids better. And that is true. I did. You know, I travel all the time. I realize that is important. But it's even the culture's become so strongly anti-discourse that it's even hard to speak with my teenage daughter because it's always hard to speak sometimes with a teenage daughter. But in a sense of, you know, marking your strict lines and not in the sand that is very, it's kind of toxic. Now I tended to change a bit as you do get to know people better. So I guess making deep friendships is still useful.
I've been saying something really interesting, and I think it, you know, we've seen it, I guess in the circles that we, you know, live in, you know, we both are exposed to the art world and, you know, various different kind of elite worlds, if you want to call it that. And I found COVID to be really interesting because yes, COVID is the biggest thing to happen to humanity to actually stop us, right? And get us to a place of, if you want, taking the time to really think about your impact on the world, think about your impact on society, think about your impact on those around you. But it's also the perfect excuse to exclude people from your life. You know, the amount of times I've heard friends say, oh, well, you can come, but no, that person can't come because I don't know where that person's been. You know, it's like, We create these borders, these prisms, and I think that's really interesting to see. You know, we're all meant to be having a shared experience because we're all dealing with a pandemic, but, you know, people deal with it in different ways. Some people go to islands. Some people go to warmer locations. You know, some people are pent up in kind of matchbox apartments. We have to be conscious of that. I think it's, again, so important. If you can't understand or at least try to understand someone's experience, the anguish or obstacles that they may have to face or may be facing, then how are you going to communicate with them, right? And this, again, is what we saw represented in D.C. this past week. You have a bunch of people that are hugely disconnected from the reality that majority of the people in the country have. But how did they get there? You know, no one's asking that question. How did they get there? And what can we do to actually learn more about them so that we can have a conversation with them, right? And not just call them, you know, basically filth and, you know, terrorists. And because, yes, they may represent those things. But, you know, it's funny to me when I think about my grandfather, he was the number one terrorist in South Africa, right? Until he wasn't.
And then he was
the number one patron.
Have you been vocal about how you would deal with censorship in this case and keeping dialogue going so that that it's not about villainization versus understanding?
Well, I wouldn't. Again, I think when I speak to friends of mine that are in tech and you know, even friends that are in media and across the board. Look, one of them was like, it's Orwellian what we're seeing today. They just banned Parler. And, you know, I spoke to him about the larger kind of issues we've seen from far-right nationalists and how that is dangerous. You know, and I ended up wanting to have a five-minute conversation with them about Uganda, and we had a 45-minute conversation about the Upper West Side and about Parler. But, you know, I think the mistake that all of these organizations are making is just because you ban these things on your platform doesn't mean people aren't going to be able to communicate, particularly people that want to communicate, right? So all you're doing is pushing this right further into the dark, right? So it's in a sense, it's more hidden away, right? But it doesn't go anywhere. And this was the biggest thing I think about, you know, Trump coming into power in the first place is like these people existed and their views existed before Trump was there. Right.
Yeah.
He just brought them to light. And it's debatable whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. Right. In a way, it's a good thing because we're no longer living under this illusion. Right. Or auspice that everything is OK and we've progressed so far. And right. We realize that we actually still have a lot of work to do. And I think the danger here is by ostracizing these people so much. Right. You begin to radicalize them in ways and shapes this country has never seen before. And that's the worry for me, you know, as I raise a kid in America at the moment.
Right. At what point will it be just assumed, and then maybe this already is true, that we are too liberal, cosmopolitan to be in conversation with anymore, and you can only be in civil war against? And it feels like this is where we could be approaching. And
I think it's important to have people that can heal this country and bring it together. You know, it's funny. I used to have these conversations with Tom Reese. And, you know, he was deeply passionate about the Democrat Party and deeply passionate about the fact that they've, you know, lost their way when it comes to storytelling. And this was after, you know, Hillary Clinton had lost in 2016. And one of the remarks he made, he was like, well, you know, it's just those people in these backward places. And I said, stop yourself and just think what you said. You know, you called them backwards, right? That implies that you're better than them. Now, what makes you feel that you're better than them? And then he, you know, he took it back and he thought about it. But it's often that's, you know, how we kind of look at this if we're being honest. And you just, you know, you raised it. And it's how do we begin to change those views, right? Because every single person in this country is, for the most part, an American or living in the American kind of prism of the world. Do they not deserve to be treated in that way, right? Do they not deserve to get the benefit of the doubt, regardless of where they may come from? The generalizations that we've created, right? The echo chambers that we've created, these many worlds that we've created where one is better than the other and one hoards more money than the other or is more powerful than the other, you know, changing that culture is so important. And unfortunately, you know, I don't think there's been that leadership in recent time. And I think this goes beyond just Trump.
Yeah, it was interesting. I don't know if you saw this, but Sam Harris, you know, Sam Harris at all?
I don't.
Tell me about him.
He's a neuroscientist. He has a podcast. He's written a lot of books. He's a real influencer in, I don't know, some science and tech circles, but, you know, philosophy as well. But for sure identified himself with the left and was very anti-Trump, and I believe still is. But on his, he put out to it on his sort of a solo podcast the day before the election, where he said, "I finally get it. I finally get Trump voters. He said the Democrats, which he is one of and identifies as, basically make people feel bad. That what they're doing is, you know, guilt over global warming, guilt over, you know, feeling ostracized, guilt, and that Trump voters had actually seen somebody that they felt was trying to empower them, and was never blaming his own voters. And I thought that, you know, that was an interesting way to say it. I thought it was interesting. And then I said, well, Sam is really still speaking about a white experience.
Right.
And so and then I said, you know, actually, he does insult people that are minorities. The first thing he did was the travel ban, then the border wall. And so it was a very white comment to make. However, there's some truth that deserves a little bit of exploration and empathy when thinking about those who supported Trump.
Yeah, but even those who didn't support Trump are not, you know, free of a lot of the things that Trump represents, right? If we're going to look at the basis of who Trump is and what Trump represents, right? Where was Trump born? Where did Trump grow up? Where did Trump learn to, like, you know, cut his skin at business? Where did Trump learn to become a successful businessman? Where did Trump, you know, gain this kind of feeling and need to always win from, right? Where did Trump ultimately get to a place where he feels resentment and wanted to exact revenge on certain businessmen? You can look no further than New York.
Yeah, exactly. This goes from Queens and history, and then look amongst ourselves. Yeah.
So I think often we need to actually just, as you said, look at ourselves, you know, turn the mirror on ourselves and say, what is it that we create in our societies where that's okay, right? In the corporate world, that's okay. But as soon as you become, you know, a leader of a free country, it's not okay because we tag morality to it, right? And an expectation that you're meant to act in a certain way. And that may be true. You are, you know, meant to act in a certain way, or people love it when you do act in a certain way. But I still think we need to go back to the core, you know, again, what created someone like Trump, right? And what's drawn so many people to him.
Do you know, there are so few people that speak the way you do about this. How is this so much, but probably, and I mean, I certainly would never want to speak for your grandfather, but it certainly sounds like something that if you were having this conversation, might be an interesting conversation to channel him through. Is there something that in the South African experience that we should be looking to historically to understand how we can go about healing, and what pitfalls there might be where South Africa failed?
I think South Africa is still a work in progress construct. It's a miracle in a lot of ways because it was able to overcome what was, you know, the brink of civil war between 1990 and 1993. You know, hundreds of thousands of people lost their lives, and we were that close. I think one of the things that not just my grandfather, but the many men and women who were fighting apartheid were very clear on was what was the motivation of the enemy, so to speak? What was the motivation of the system that was probably the most well thought out racial and segregated system in the world? You know, what was it informed by? What was it created by? you know? And I think once they started to understand that, they started to understand how they could begin to negotiate with it, how they could break it down, what they needed to do ultimately to create a society that was different to the one that was posed in front of them. And one of the key aspects that I think they found very early on by doing research and learning, you know, learning the language of, you know, the very people that were oppressing them, they realized that these people had historically, you know, been scarred. They were put in the world's first concentration camp well before the Nazis did it, by the British in South Africa. And so they came out of there fiercely nationalistic and fiercely, you know, not willing to go back into that position, and with very staunch and strong views about how they had to treat other communities. That's not dissimilar from some of the things we've seen in modern society, where people have felt like they are persecuted, have been persecuted, and their response, you know, can tend to be drastic after that.
So where are things today in your view, if you were to look at where we could be learning right now from each other as countries, or are we all in this global pandemic and fighting the same battles in your view?
I think South Africa tried something that was pretty unique. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a place for restorative justice, a place for them to investigate crimes that had taken place all throughout apartheid, whether those be murders, whether those be robberies, whether those be, you know, stealing of land, and in a form offer, you know, reparations for those, justice for those, also leniency in the cases where, you know, people had come forward from a genuine place and talked about the fact that they were young, they didn't know what they were doing. I think America's never had that. I think, you know, Australia's never had that. Britain's never had that. And I think it's important to start looking at that. And I think, you know, you can look at this in a multitude of ways. I talked about Me Too and Time's Up, which, you know, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on that, Matt. But how those forums don't actually have a place for men to find restorative justice. You know, if a man had, you know, been an asshole or sexually harassed someone, or, you know, just been a creep, you know, what is a way for him to go and actually learn from this experience, speak to those people that may have been affected by that, and either, you know, get some sort of justice from it or some sort of punishment from it, right? But have a form where they can even begin to engage in that, right? And they're not just cast, you know, to the side or told that they need to shut up or canceled. And I think, again, you know, when we talk about the systemic racism that exists, when we talk about things like police brutality, when we talk about how, you know, funds that are directed to education or housing or any of these things, job opportunities for people of color, placement on boards for people of color, actual engagement, you know, from an entire country and society, I think a lot could be done by actually looking to address these issues from, you know, the very onset. And again, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I think, would be extremely helpful to this country across the board.
I think about this all the time, too, that our country is, I don't know if it's always been this way, but it certainly is right now, that it's incredibly punitive. Really, we have a, when there is something that is socially correct or, you know, or incorrect or misjudged, there's no going back. When you're guilty, you're to be punished for it. And this, and the punishments can be so severe that there is no going back, with any type of forgiveness or trying to understand what was behind it in the first place. Eventually, we all start being slightly dishonest. You know, how much does the fear of Me Too lead to us not being able to say, you know, I did something wrong at this point, I'd like forgiveness for it, and I will pay a price. But the price doesn't need to, you know, I need to explore if I have even done anything. I have to explore who I am. And, you know, this is... you know, as I really am concerned about. I'm glad to see that there is a social justice movement. But I think that even where things are really bad, that kind of condemning somebody and then saying, you know, hugging them is afterwards, and it is better than always further arming ourselves in a sense. I only said that because you asked my feelings on this.
No, I think it's important to hear that. I mean, because it definitely is something that, you know, we live with in society right now. And I think particularly as men, we tend to feel differently or tend to see it differently than women do, just because we've experienced it differently. But I think part of learning, part of growing is like us seeing other men, you know, who may have been part of that or played a role in that, actually, again, if needs be, getting punished for it, but also being able to talk about it from their perspective and their view, and equally hearing from the people they may have perpetrated it against.
Yeah, I think that there is definitely the right time here for being fairly, you know, outspokenly feminist right now. It's wonderful to hear, even if it leans in one direction. It's always good to see those that have been disempowered to be empowered and for us to learn from it. And you know, it's certainly a net positive. I think that it's not so much about Me Too as it is about making sure that we don't take an easy solution to any of these things, which is I can cancel it, right? Cancel culture is a little bit dangerous. It's sometimes useful to cancel people. It's useful to cancel them from your own life because it can give you enormous amount of misery and can bring to others. However, it does stop this discourse that you were speaking about earlier. So
yeah, but people are entitled to that. And I, you know,
totally, I think they're entitled to it. I think though, if a society in general does it completely, then we do lose conversation.
Yeah. And again, it goes to a deeper thing. You know, when we look at, you know, why these things take place in the first place, you know, maybe one of the biggest things is that there aren't enough women that are CEOs and then on boards of these companies that are driving the agenda of what kind of protections need to be in place for women, what type of gender parity should be in place. Right. And that's a much deeper thing to have a conversation around. Right. And so, because we're not able to actually look at these things and they get turned into moments or sound bites, you know, it becomes something, as you said, that lives in an echo chamber and people can decide if they want to cancel or not cancel it.
I do like the idea of forcing certain things in the corporate world, as you said. In tech, there's even one other layer I'm not sure if you've thought about much, but I have had some interviews on this and also just spoken with friends in AI. Mm-hmm. So in creating AI algorithms, it can become very biased in a sense, even if you're not deliberately building bias in. If it's a bunch of, you know, young Aspergery white men writing AI algorithms, they don't need to be explicitly sexist or racist or even classist or whatever it might be. It just is who they are, right? And AIs have this potential to be, you know, they influence everything we do, and it's going to be all the more so, the more powerful. So forcing women into positions of power within companies that are creating AI algorithms is, I think, necessary. And then the effects of that will, I think that there will be this, you know, this will perpetuate into other areas of society as well. We will have our algorithms no longer be biased for ads as much as they were when a woman or a minority or somebody would normally not be doing this. So there are great ramifications. Have you thought about artificial intelligence much?
Yeah, I mean, I have. Look, I think there's resistance to a lot of AI because people fear it's, you know, first off, a lot of people fear it's going to take their jobs and their purpose, their sense of purpose. Then there is maybe some truth to that because there's so much misunderstanding around that. I think it's interesting how, you know, universal basic income has become a big thing that a number of people have talked about. And I know a couple of African countries and particular communities there are piloting different versions of that. You know, it's interesting, Matt, you talked about kind of getting, you know, programmers who are mainly white males to hand over the kind of throne to women, which I think is very important and should be done. I think the problem is whenever you see these shifts happen, I've seen it again in the art world with some of my friends, right? When there was a shift towards more African-American and Latin artists being shown, right, at places like the Whitney, et cetera. My friends who were white males or white females turned around and said, oh, well, you know, that cuts me out from having an opportunity or whatever, and felt that they were being prejudiced against in some shape or form, right? And I think you'd face a similar thing in the tech world. And so how do you begin to have those conversations? How do you begin to bridge that is more what I'm really trying to figure out, because unless you can do that, nothing is going to actually change, right? It's just going to be conversations that we're having, or it might be, there might be a small movement where, you know, people decide to do a protest, you know, online or maybe even in person. But, you know, the culture is still going to stay the same.
Yeah, no, it's a tough question. And you do get to look at places, different places, see how they're addressing it. One thing I've noticed is that South Africa actually is putting a lot of effort and money and curriculum choices behind educating young people in artificial intelligence. I took a look at it over the weekend, and it's much, much stronger than ours. This surprised me a little bit. You know, we pride ourselves on being the great innovators in this type of technology, but there is very little in my kids' education, for instance, that would compare to what I'm seeing is going into South African education right now for AI. Did you know about this? Are you involved with this at all?
Yeah, I'm aware. I mean, even when I was in high school there, which is, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, they were talking about artificial intelligence, and we were learning aspects of that in our programming classes. You know, I think as Africa as a whole, there's been a kind of acknowledgement by governments that this is going to be the future, that future digital jobs are going to be reliant on artificial technology, and that you have to prepare what is the youngest youth population in the world for that. I think here there's been, you know, again, quite a big resistance because the mere word AI for a lot of communities means that they could potentially lose their jobs.
Right.
So it's hard to talk about incorporating that into education systems and all of that, right? If the general consensus is that.
Yeah, there's so many issues with American education that we have to dig into. At what point, how long it takes to change curriculum to address people's concern for job opportunities. They've been pretty slow in the past, and when they've been fast, it's generally not incredibly well informed, sadly. But I make sometimes connections that shouldn't be made, and I'm curious if you think about this at all. When I'm talking about, you know, the AI education in South Africa, and looking at then COVID response, how and speed of response, how much do young people who came up thinking about logic or are right now coming about thinking of logic in a way that would be defined by something like setting a utility function, which is the name of this podcast, based on your ultimate goals, and then, you know, figuring out what those inputs should be. You know, the idea of AI basically in this regard, or deep learning network, define what it is you'd like to achieve and then figure out what inputs you need to get there. And I always think the most difficult thing is defining what it is you need. And it seems the simplest to everybody, you know, but it's so nuanced that the results can take a strange path,
right,
depending on what it is you choose. Just choosing to educate your population in artificial intelligence, machine learning, is already a strong indicator of the way a society might move. And it may be an indicator of how a society would react to a global pandemic. But I have no idea. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I mean, there may be truth in that, because when you look at the statistics, not just of South Africa, but of the African continent, you know, it's the lowest. They have the lowest amount of cases outside of the Pacific, which obviously has a much, you know, smaller population. You know, there's 1 billion people on the African continent, and I think there's like under 3 million infections currently on the continent. A lot of that comes down to their previous history dealing with infectious diseases, you know, such as Ebola, such as malaria and TB, and the screening protocols, the contact tracing protocols that they have across the continent. I'm not sure if that's informed by, you know, what's been taught at elementary and high school and even tertiary level on the continent. I can't imagine that it's not in some shape or form, but I just don't know enough about it.
When I think about this, though, putting the education of AI specifically out of it and say there was never AI spoken, the idea of how to set goals and then base it on your previous experience seems to very much play into this. But now, even though things were better, in a sense, things are getting really rough in South Africa right now with COVID. And this is a case where the subtleties have to be looked at. So while South Africa was really good, and by the way, I have no idea what could have been better, but this is where the setting your goal and figuring out what the inputs are becomes so important and can't be necessarily generalized. And so, you know, there's something going wrong right now. Do you think that's just something inevitable with the fact that we're dealing with something that is so transmissible as COVID? Or do you think there were some early choices that could have prevented current problems with COVID?
There's always, you know, choices that could have prevented it, but you're also dealing with, 60 million people, a lot of them who, regardless of what you say and what you try and institute and impose, are going to live their lives. I think it's similar here in the States.
Well, there's no question we've done an awful job. So that goes without saying.
But I think everyone's been trying to figure out how to deal with it, and has to do with culture. It has to do with, you know, people's trust and belief in the government. It has to do with, you know, the resources that are available. South Africa and the UK have the exact same amount of population. They each have 60 million, right? South Africa and the UK both went into lockdown in April at the same time. You know, they've both been dealing with new variants. South Africa is currently, as of today, has 21,000 cases. The UK has 56,000. So again, when you look at that, is South Africa doing better than most countries in Europe? Yes. Is it doing better than most countries in Africa? No. And so those questions need to be raised, undoubtedly. Can they do a better job? I'm sure they can if they want to impose a total lockdown again. But then there's economic ramifications that go with that. There's societal health, mental health ramifications that go with that. So I think there's a number of things that you factor in beyond just looking at it as a straight kind of virus transmission that needs to be done. And we're facing those very questions here. We're talking about millions, literally millions of new infections in a matter of weeks that are taking place in America, which is astounding for the most powerful country in the world. And, you know, again, there haven't really been, you know, questions asked as to why this is. Is it a lack of coordination at a national level? Is it the fact that, unfortunately, you have misinformation around the impacts of this? Is it the fact that, you know, certain parts of society just won't listen either way? I think we really need to figure out and get to the bottom of what the core issues are that exist that have allowed it to get as bad as it has, not just here, but around the world.
There's one thing that I tend to take comfort in the United States, and comfort in, and actually I get frustrated first, and then I allow myself to get comfortable with, which was the speed that we were able to get a vaccine approved through this emergency use approval by the FDA. Now I'm only, it doesn't make me that much less frustrated with our leadership, and by leadership I don't mean Trump's only. I mean, this applies to authority with throughout the government and private industry. So, but we were able to get what I think is one of the most powerful new technologies. Well, I would say it's probably a 12-year-old technologies, out faster than any vaccine in history. And there was talk that in South Africa, the SAHPRA was a slow-moving organization like the American FDA. But I was just reading yesterday that there might be a way that they are creating a type of emergency use approval to not only for vaccines, but to get therapeutics and ways of treating done quicker. I mean, it begs the question whether the United States and South Africa should have thought about this stuff and done it in January when we knew things were starting to get bad, rather than just thought about whether lockdowns or not were the only answer. But do you see that the bureaucracies that might exist are, noticing the need to move quicker now, even in the last few weeks?
Yeah, I think, again, because there needs to be so many different tiers of government, and public health, and scientists that are involved, and everyone has a different opinion. And then, how do you actually distribute it? And I think that's been one of the big key kind of hurdles here, is actually having enough people that can administer it, getting over, there's a public sentiment where people are skeptical about this. So how do you get to herd immunity at 60%, that 200 million people here? How do we get to 40 million people in South Africa? I think in South Africa, the government's at least identified key retail, places where it can be administered, and it can be administered in great numbers. And now it's been about approving, the various different vaccines. I know the AstraZeneca one, because it was tested and trialed in South Africa, has been approved. And I believe at the end of this month, those doses start arriving. I don't think typically, governments, because they operate on a 4 to 5 year trajectory of where they're going to be, I don't think they think long term about these things. And so they're reactionary most of the time. And I think particularly with COVID, everyone was reactionary. No one had any kind of major foresight around how to handle this.
Yeah, hopefully we do wake up a bit. I wonder if in Africa in general there is any lessons that that are being gained other than early lockdowns or tracing, which absolutely were helpful. But anything about the way that a population has responded and whether it has caused civil unrest or not civil unrest due to policy that we can learn from out of this?
You know, I think Africa's got a number of things, again, when it came to COVID, that worked in its favor. So there's a couple of great articles. There's one in Foreign Politics. There's one in The Economist. There's one in The Financial Mail where journalists talked about traveling last year in January, through the States to Europe. And then, a couple of those journalists went to Africa and they were talking about how in Africa, at every airport that they landed in, there was already thermal screening as you arrived. And this was before the world even knew about COVID, right? And then when there was COVID, there were people in hazmat suits who were going and checking your temperature and actually, asking you detailed questionnaires. And if for any reason that they felt that you could have been exposed, they were, testing you. And so I think, again, coming out of something like Ebola, which was devastating for Western and Central Africa, there was a real strong sense continent-wide of how to deal with a disease like this. Then you look at the fact that 75% of the population in Africa is under the age of 25 years old. So we have a young population. And so the spread of COVID would not be as fatal to a population like that. Then you have to look at the fact that, from an international air travel point of view, Africa doesn't, outside of, maybe a handful of countries, Egypt, Kenya, Ghana, South Africa, doesn't really have high traffic volume. And so the spread of a disease that's largely coming from, at that time, Europe and Asia is not going to be as high. There's all those things that factor in. And I think, now looking forward, the continent's biggest issue is their economies and how they kickstart their economies and how they shape those economies for the future. And I think, again, this is pause can be looked at as a positive because it's made these countries stop and actually look at what their core purpose is going to be. And as you said, that can be driven by technology and AI. It can be driven by a hybrid of agriculture, which is ever important right now because there is an inordinate amount of arable land in Africa that's not being utilized. Education's a massive thing. Water protection, food security, the list goes on and on. But I do remain positive about where the continent is going. And, I remain very positive about where America's going. I think oftentimes when you're faced with these challenges, it helps you to realize that you have more work to do and maybe brings a number of people together that can begin to create a better future, not just for this country, but the world.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I'm definitely an optimist in general. And there have been moments, like I'm sure for many people, where I've gone through this roller coaster of being horrified by the way that humans have behaved in the future of the planet to being incredibly hopeful that we can do more than we've ever thought possible, not just because of the pandemic, but because of self-reflection or internal reflection to, family, like you said, or looking even at our own country versus the other and studying more, whatever that might be. It's interesting. You and I met at a place called Pioneer Works in Brooklyn, which is also this, I think, kind of local community, but at the same time, strangely cosmopolitan driven, utopia of what could be. Sure. And I was super worried that Pioneer Works wouldn't survive through a time where we couldn't come together. And we realized that we had support during that time, even though we thought it was about physical space, and it will be again, but a dedication to our values of wanting something like this to exist, even if we couldn't buy it right now. And that gave me kind of hope for humanity in general. It's like somebody will donate money to something that they get no use of at that moment. That seems like not planning super far in the future, but it's still more planning than most people do for their entertainment on a regular basis, for instance.
Yeah, it shows the power of the community and people coming together, the collective, right? And not being reliant on a bank or, you know, government loan, but being reliant, self-reliant on each other. You know, I think we've seen that again throughout this pandemic. In many, many different ways, whether that's through a cultural organization like Pioneer Works, or that's just someone, you know, supporting their local grocery or fruit store or restaurant. You know, all of that has a role and plays a part in the world that we want to see.
What are you working on artistically these days?
You know, I'm working on some film projects. I released two with Paramount at the end of last year. One was called Jungle Land, which was starring Charlie Hunnam, Jack O'Connell, and Jonathan Majors. The story of two brothers who are bare-knuckle boxers in Boston, who are down on their luck, just trying to scrape by in life, and they're offered an opportunity by a local crime boss who asked them to take a young woman across the country to Reno. And they accept it. They begin to drive her across the country, and slowly she begins to transform their lives. And then the second one, which also has land in it, this was not intentional, called Dreamland, is a film with Margot Robbie. It's set in Texas in the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, and she plays a bank robber on the run. And the authorities are offering a reward for her capture or killing. And a young 15-year-old kid hears about this and sets off in search of her, and actually finds her before anyone else does, and realizes she's kind of different to what people have been saying. And they go on this little adventure together. And so those are my two recent projects. There's another two that will come out later this year, one called Gully, which is the feature film debut of Nabil Elderkin, who's a longtime commercial and music video director. And that looks at a disconnected youth. It was shot and is set in South Central Los Angeles. And the other is a film that Christoph Waltz directed in his directorial debut and also stars in with Annette Bening. Called Georgetown, which kind of looks at the political elite in Washington, D.C.
Have you noticed that any of your choices of projects to do have changed during this time where our travel is different and human interaction is different?
I can't say that I have, to be honest. I think I've always, you know, followed passionate stories that, you know, interested me from a human level. And sometimes, you know, those are stories about, you know, people shooting up banks, and other times, you know, it's about two brothers who are hopelessly lost and have a really low IQ. But there's something human about them. There's something real. There's something we can all see ourselves in. So yeah, I don't have a specific kind of interest point now that the pandemic's come, to be honest with you. I think I've tried to just focus on stories that interest me.
Have you been reading anything or listening to anything that you'd recommend lately that you've discovered?
You know, there's been one book, which is The Revolt of the Public. I don't know if you've read that, heard of that.
I haven't. No, I have not.
It's by Martin Gurry. Who I'm sure, as you know, was a CIA analyst who studied media trends. And it's a remarkable book. A couple of good friends of mine who work in that kind of intelligence space recommended it, mainly because it predicted a lot of the stuff that we saw this past Wednesday. It predicted Brexit and Trump, and it talks about where we're kind of heading in the world, and how there's this chasm between those who control the media and control, you know, major multinationals and the general public that we've talked about.
that now, you know, sources their media for themselves, or has found alternative outlets, so to speak.
It's interesting that you mentioned that book. It's as if we're looking for oracles at this point, when it's maybe difficult for us to see ourselves through the fog of everything going on. I like the idea of picking it up for sure. There's probably a lot of examples of that, actually.
There are.
Consciously or subconsciously, we look for these oracles.
Yeah, I mean, I think we do. It's, and sometimes we're just looking for people to inspire us. I picked up A Promised Land, Obama's book, and that's been a slow one. I've had it for maybe a month. I'll definitely finish it, but I'm also going through it extremely slowly. Yeah, I think we're in this mood. At least for me, I'm in this mood to understand what other people see more than I ever have been in my life before.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I wouldn't have had a podcast in the past. You know, this is something I want to learn from you. I want to learn from people and to see what that perspective is that's different. I've always done that. I mean, I've always been intellectually curious, but to engage, to read or watch a movie that somebody made and then, you know, if they were somebody that I got to know personally, like you,
yeah,
and then to dig one step deeper and then share that with others is really cool. I have to say, it's it becomes more important than some. Unlike you, I have sort of updated in some regards of my own priorities, my own identity, and you know, it's worth us all taking a little, you know, a glimpse and how we see ourselves, I think. And, you know, when we're looking for others to give us a new lens from that. And I think that certainly you've probably thought of this forever. I mean, your grandfather is a lens for us to look through, you know, so much. And you've now you've created art. You've been involved in so much that has given another generation a chance to look at things. But I really appreciate you, you know, taking this time. I know you're busy doing a lot over this weekend and in general, but it means a lot to me.
No, anytime. I really enjoyed this and I appreciate you doing it. I think it's important again to, you know, to share, and to bring people together. So
thank you, Kwaku. Next time in person. I'll see you in person, I hope, soon.
Definitely.